I'd like to welcome everyone to the Spotlight today. Just a couple of things before we get started. There are archives of our Spotlight programs available for your listening convenience. And to get to those, you go to the front page and click on our Galaxy of Stars. And let's see, what else do I have here? We want to thank, of course, our good buddy Start Button there for his expertise in recording our Spotlights, so that we can have them archived. We'll ask that you hold your questions and comments for our guests until the end of the interview. And, of course, remind everyone that text messaging is not permitted in this room. And with that, I'll turn it over to Country Music Mar to introduce our guest today. Mar?
Well, thank you so much there, Miss Becky. And it is once again my honor and privilege to be here interviewing someone who, within the past month or so, I can honestly consider a friend. And as during the course of our conversation, I'm going to tell you, she's bailed me out once here, and I'm going to talk about that because she's just a great gal, and she's got such a wonderful, bubbly, warm personality, and I'm sure everybody is going to be so interested in hearing about her life. I'd like to welcome Peg from Ohio to our Spotlight program today. Good morning, Peg. I mean, good afternoon. I'm sorry. It's afternoon where you are.
Well, you called me Peg, so I'll answer whether it's morning or afternoon or wherever it is. It's all different kinds of the day in different places, but I just want to thank you for inviting me to be on the Spotlight.
You are very welcome. And as I said, it's just really neat to be... I never thought that I would have the opportunity to get to know some of my friends in this way, and this is a great way for me to get to know about you other than just conversation on the For the People rooms and things like that. So I guess the best thing to do is to start at the beginning. You are from Ohio, and were you born and raised in Ohio? Have you lived there all of your life?
Yes, I have. I've lived in Ohio all my life except for a few months when I did live in Texas for a very brief time. I was born in a town called Portsmouth, Ohio. It's a river city, and right now the population is probably about 22,000 people. I have one brother and one sister who are both older than I am, so I was the baby, and... I've lived here pretty much all my life.
All right. Well, have you been blind since birth, and what is your eye condition?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story. Actually, I have been blind since birth, and it was not discovered, though, until I was about 7 months old, and my mother kept telling everybody that this child is blind, and of course everybody was in denial, and, you know, they didn't want to accept the fact. And they took me everywhere. My eyes looked completely normal, but my mother said that I did not respond to anyone. I did not look at anyone. I did not reach for objects. But if a sound happened, I would react to the sound and reach. So she, mother that she was, sensed that I was blind, and they took me all over the place to different doctors and took me to Johns Hopkins and all kinds of stuff, and they finally decided that I had an atrophied optic nerve, that it was not developed properly. And so they did, they tried everything. I wore glasses, like that was going to really enlighten my eyes, and I was suddenly going to be able to see. I don't know, but anyway, I finally, believe it or not, went through my whole life until I was about 35 believing that I had a damaged optic nerve. And when I was about 35, I was under the had my case open with the rehab agency here in the state of Ohio, and they gave me the opportunity to get re-diagnosed. So I went and did that, and the first thing that the ophthalmologist said was, there's not a darn thing wrong with your optic nerve, dear. You have a healthier optic nerve than most people. And I'm like, what? You know, so they began to do all these tests, and And, of course, what they ended up finding out was that I have what's called Leber's. The full name is Leber's congenital amaurosis, which is a retinal disorder where you don't have cones and rods on your retina, so you cannot see because you can't process light at all. So that's what they finally discovered. And, of course, back in my day when I was born, they didn't even know what Leber's was. And so I guess I've had two eye conditions in my life, one that I knew about and one that I didn't. But anyway, so that's the story of my blind thing.
That's really interesting that you went through that much of your life being misdiagnosed, basically. So as you were growing up, obviously you had two older siblings, and at what point in your life do you remember realizing that you were different from the kids around you and from the world around you?
I don't think that I really realized it. I mean, I don't think I really realized it until I went to the School for the Blind at age 5. And I noticed that the kids handled me differently. You know, like I remember, you know, like if they'd go to hand me something, they would touch my hand and put it in my hand instead of just holding it out and expecting me to try to find it and things like that. I don't think I really got it that, and you know, I remember making a remark to my mom after I went to that school that I loved it that the kids were normal there. I do remember telling her that. Wow, they got normal kids there, you know, that know how to hand me stuff and everything.
Oh, that's funny. That's really interesting because I never even thought about that before. But I know I've, you know, tried to hand something to a blind person and whatever, and every once in a while we'll kind of grope and try to find each other's hands, and it can be a little awkward sometimes, but it's interesting that it was the opposite situation when you went to school. Now, did you live a long way away from school? Did you stay in the dormitory at school, or were you able to go home every night?
No, I stayed in the dormitory, and I remember when I first went, and elaborating on the handing thing, you know, I did have a lot of interaction with children in the neighborhood, but they would, like, hold it out and expect me to reach out and get it. And I never could figure out why I had so much trouble when they'd tell me they were going to give me something, and they wouldn't do it, you know. And then at school, they would find my hand and give it to me, and I thought that was so cool. But anyway, I lived about 100 miles from the school, and I did get to go home every weekend. And I remember when I first went, I was just terrified and never had a clue when I was planning all this that my mother was going to leave me there. I don't know what I thought, but I just thought she was going to stay. And when I discovered that they were leaving, I just fell to pieces, and I was extremely homesick. And I remember my mother and one of the formidable house parents had a big argument because they told my mom not to call me. And my mom said, if my baby wants to come home, I don't care if it's tomorrow, you call me because I'm her mother and I know what I'm doing. And if she knows that she can count on me to come and get her whenever she asks me, then she will get used to this. So I did it. I tested my mom 3 times, and she came and got me in the middle of the week and took me home and then would bring me back. And then after about the 3rd time, she said, I stopped calling. And she would just say, you know, I'll see you Friday, and I would wait it out. So she knew me pretty well, but she had to really argue with the house parents to convince them that it was the right thing for them to let me call and let me go home.
Isn't that something? Well, I can certainly relate to the homesickness and the feeling of abandonment because I felt a very similar thing. Of course, I lived 250 miles away from school, so it was even farther. But so as you progressed in school and things like that, I assume that you started making friends and you started feeling more comfortable with being there and not quite so homesick. Was your overall experience at school a good one?
Yes, it was. I really loved the friends that I made, and I have some of them still in my life, and it was a very a good experience. But I never, ever got over the homesick stuff. Never. I had wonderful parents and a wonderful home life, and I never really got over it. I did get to where I liked to stay at school, and my mother could never figure that out, because on the weekends I would want to stay there to be, you know, in the social activities and things, and it was worth it not to go home. But I, you know, if I got under any strain or stress whatsoever, I was ready, man. I wanted to go home. I didn't want to stay, or I wanted to talk to my parents, and I always had the thing in the back of my head that I wanted to go to public school so that I could be home. However, at that time, there was only one school that I could go to in my area, and I had to pay tuition because I was out of the district, and so my father just forbade it. He wouldn't let me go. So I never got over the homesickness, but I really had wonderful experiences at school. And I, you know, I witnessed things. I've heard so many other people talk on here, and the same goes for me. Opportunities that I would have never had I not been there. The musical opportunities, being able to go out to concerts, plays, and things like that. It was just absolutely wonderful. And plus all the wonderful friends that I made. And although I loved going home in the summer, and like I said, I did have wonderful friends in the neighborhood, I always sort of dreaded it, you know, and I couldn't wait to get back and see all my friends.
So you had friends at school as well as friends in the sighted community in your age group. I think that's a very good thing, because I didn't have too many sighted friends, especially when I was a young child.
Yeah, I was lucky there. My mother, of course, you know, there were problems that at the time as a child I was not aware of at all. But my mother, you know, encouraged me to play with the other kids and in the neighborhood, and we had a ton of them. And I would just get right out there, and of course I rode bikes and did all those kinds of things. And once they figured out I couldn't see, most of them were pretty accommodating, although they were all a bit baffled. And I did have some problems, you know, some problems with interaction with the kids. And I remember one problem in particular, a story that comes to my mind was, it's really funny, but when I was little, I had a very, very close friend, one that was closer than all the others. She was actually about 3 years younger than I was, but we were pretty much inseparable. And there was another child in the neighborhood, well, actually she lived behind us, and she actually lived in the apartments where I live right now. That's what's so funny about it. And she, her mother managed the apartments. And she was one of these kids, you know, that she didn't have many friends, but she was real covetous and, you know, and possessive and kind of jealous and a lot of those emotions. And anyway, she wanted to be with this friend of mine all the time, but the friend was always with me, so she was doing things to try to influence this girl to stop running around with me. And at one point in time, we got permission from our parents to come over here to her apartment, and basically, and I don't know how she talked my other friend into going along with this, but basically what they did was they got me in the apartment, and then they ran out and locked me in somehow, and locked me in this strange apartment, and I was absolutely petrified. It was somebody's strange house, and I had been taught enough about etiquette that I didn't want to go blundering around and break something. I had no idea where a phone was. I'm trying to think. I was probably about 10 or so when this happened, and they locked me in this apartment, and I was in there for about 20 minutes, which seemed like an eternity to me, and scared to death her mom would come in and find me there, but yet wishing she would, you know, and hating that kid with all I was worth, you know. I hated her. But about 20 minutes later, my girlfriend Donna, who was the friend, you know, that I was telling you about, came and rescued me and was crying and said she was so sorry that she couldn't believe that she had allowed this to happen and all this. And course, you know, then my mom wouldn't let me play with any of them for quite some time until she discovered that I was going to sneak out and do it anyway, so she finally let me. But what's so funny is now I'm living in these same apartments.
How ironic can that be? You know, it seems like a lot of us have had experiences like that. I remember some kids took me to a playground one time and got me lost, and I was scared. So it seems like sighted kids have a way of doing that sometimes to us blind kids. Let's go back to your school experience, and of course those of us who frequent the cabaret have had the wonderful experience of hearing your beautiful, rich voice. At what point in your life did you start to realize that you might be interested in music?
Well, you know, when I was little in the first grade, you know, I remember they would go around and ask us, a teacher was taping us, and she'd go around and ask us what we wanted to do when we grew up, and I, of course, would say I wanted to be a music teacher. But really, I was interested in music. I always loved it. I always listened to it and all that, but I never really, I just sort of went along. And, of course, music was a big part of the school life there. And I joined everything I could join. I was in chorus, I was in band, and I was in, you know, any ensemble, any vocal ensemble, or they had a madrigal at one time, and I was tried out for that, and I always made those things. And I always enjoyed them and always went along with whatever there was musically to get involved with in school. And I loved music of all kinds. And, of course, we took piano lessons, and, you know, I went along with that too, but never got very good, but, you know, I could play a little bit. I play at it for my own entertainment right now. Can't play and sing at the same time, never could. Just kind of went along like that, and I didn't really discover, they never allowed me to sing solos in school. I would sing in all the groups and make all the vocal groups, but I was never asked to sing a solo. And my voice has always been very low. And I never really, the songs we sang never really, although I could reach them, and they were never the comfortable range for me. I liked singing down low. And that's probably why they never asked me to sing any solo things, because I sounded so bad when I sang up high. I don't know. They were always sopranos that got to sing the solos. And finally, at the very end of my senior year in high school, they told me that they wanted me to sing a contralto solo for our baccalaureate ceremony. And I did that, and it was fair. It was all right. It was as good as anyone else's, I guess, but it didn't really knock the house down or anything. So I really went on to college. By that time, music was an interest, but it was a hobby. It was not anything I planned on, you know, getting involved with at all. And I really didn't discover my singing talents and that I could really sing, and someone would actually want to hear it or pay to hear it or anything like that until my college years.
And just for my curiosity, what instrument did you play in the band?
I tried out a lot of them. I started out on a baritone and did that okay, but then he put me on, then he switched me from a B-flat instrument to an E-flat instrument. Oh, I can't talk. An E-flat instrument, and I played alto horn, or peck horn, as we call them sometimes, quite a while. And then he decided that he wanted someone to play a horn called a flugelhorn, which is like a fat, pregnant cornet, I always say. And so I played that for a while, and then went to, I played trumpet and cornet. I played a little bit of everything. I finally settled, the last couple of years I was there, I played first cornet.
That's interesting. I played brass instruments in high school as well. Did you ever play French horn?
No, I didn't. And, of course, I had to play a brass instrument or a percussion because we, at that time, did not have a large enough student body in the band, and so we did have an all-brass band at that point when I was at school.
That's interesting. Okay, so now you're in college, and what event took place that actually helped you realize that, hey, maybe I should focus on music?
Well, it's really funny. Back when I was in the, I have to go back a little bit. Back when I was in the third grade, there was a girl, and I've often wondered whatever happened to her. Her name was Janet Gale, and she had an auto harp. And she got that thing, and she would strum it, and we'd sing, "He's got the whole world in his hands." And I thought that was the coolest thing, and I had to have one of those auto harps. And I kept telling my dad and my mom I wanted one. So one Christmas, I got an auto harp. And, of course, you know, as a child, I played around with it and sang and strummed it and everything. And then it promptly got forgotten, and I put it up in the attic. Well, I had a friend at Ohio University where I attended, and she also had gone to the School for the Blind. And we just got on this odd discussion one day about instruments, and she mentioned, had I ever seen an auto harp? I said, heck yeah, I got one up in the attic. I said, I'll drag the thing down. So I went up in the attic and got it and was showing it to her and everything. And since I'd gotten it down, I started strumming around on it and playing on it. And at that time, I was really into gospel music, and I was into a group called the Singing Rambos. And I thought she wrote, I thought Dottie wrote some really beautiful songs. And so I, one day, took it out on the porch and was sitting there kind of strumming along and singing the Rambo songs off of my records. And this next-door neighbor came over, and he said, "Where have you been hiding that beautiful voice?" And, of course, if anyone knows who Dottie Rambo is, she has a very deep voice, you know, and I'm singing down low where she is. And it just was fun. And then he invited me to sing at his church, and I'm like, what? I've never done this before in my life, but I did it. And it was just so much fun to sit around and sing all those gospel songs. And I just started doing it and started kind of course, I'd had voice training in school. And I just kind of started, you know, singing and kind of developing my voice and developing my own style. And the next thing I knew, I'd play myself back. And, you know, I was just like totally amazed. I just had no idea I could sing like that.
Well, I sure thank God for that neighbor and being outside and eavesdropping on the neighbor and hearing her sing, because I'll tell you, his discovery is definitely our gain for sure. So what subjects were you taking in college?
Well, my sister was a speech therapist, and I got interested in it because of her in the beginning, and then at school, they had a little work study program that you could get involved in, and you made a big $3 a week if you did this. And one of the things that they would allow you to do was to be a tutor, like an after school tutor, with students who needed speech therapy. The speech therapist would give you exercises that you could do with these people. And at first, it was not that interesting to me. I had some little kindergarten students, and they were very cute, but I was not a kid person back then and felt rather shy and uncomfortable. And so I worked with them, and then they gave me this high school student who had cerebral palsy and had some really bad speech problems. And I was able to see improvement as I worked with her and did these exercises and helped her. And I just really got interested in it. And so I went into speech and hearing therapy. But the problem was that the administration of the college or the people in the speech thing just absolutely fought me all the way. And at that time, we were not allowed to go to the school of our choice. We had to go to the nearest state university that offered what we wanted to take. And so my rehab counselor said, well, you know, this is just getting to be too much of a problem, and you're going to have to switch majors. So I switched at that point, but I knew I wanted to. I also discovered that I really enjoyed speaking and talking to people and, you know, making people laugh and things like that. So I decided I wanted to stay in speech. But there really wasn't a degree in speech. So I ended up getting a Bachelor of Science degree in communications with a teaching certification. And so I took speech, English, journalism, and remedial reading, and I supposedly could teach all those things with a speech emphasis.
So were you ever able to use those degrees after you left college?
No, not really. I did my student teaching and graduated, and then I married not very long after that. And so I did try to find jobs in the teaching profession, but I didn't want to leave my area, and I was running into all kinds of discriminatory things with not being able to perform administrative duties and things like that, which really amazed me that that's why they hired their teachers, to do administrative functions, and would have kept fighting for it. But I really, my heart was not in it. I wanted to be a speech therapist. I did not really care about teaching all that much. I did it because that's what the counselor said I should do. It was a very unfortunate situation, and it's kind of a shame. But I did get a degree out of it in communications. And then, as we'll get into later, I'm in communications now, so, you know, it did balance itself out, and I learned a lot. But I really didn't have a big desire to teach anyway, so I didn't really get a chance to do that, except for some private tutoring that I did later on. I did tutor some blind kids later on in high school. But other than that, I really did not use the teaching portion of my degree at all.
It sounds like you were a little disillusioned at first, the way the turn of events went there, but it certainly sounds like you were able to turn it around and eventually use the knowledge that you did have.
Yeah, I haven't given up yet. I have a crazy, an extreme wild hair to get out and become a promotional speaker. I mean, a motivational speaker at some point in my life. I have found in the profession that I'm in now that it seems to work. People seem to feel good after I speak, and I like that. I like the idea of making people feel more positive about themselves. And I'm an absolute clown. I don't know if you know that or figured it out yet, but I love to make people laugh. And so I still have a dream. I'm not done yet. You know, I've only been around almost a half a century. I got some time to go yet. So I still have a dream to get out there and do some motivational speaking at some point in my life.
Well, I think that's what keeps us forging ahead, is if we have a goal, no matter how many years we've been on this earth, I think if we have a goal, and we just keep working towards that goal, and I admire you for that. I really do, because sometimes people sort of get stuck in a rut, and it definitely sounds like you're not stuck in a rut. So you got married, and did you start a family? And if so, did you decide not to work when you had your family?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And, you know, I really wasn't, like I said, I wasn't really into the idea of teaching that much anyway and didn't miss it. It's so funny how things change as the years go by. I remember my husband had a job at the time making $2.30 an hour working in a restaurant. But I got pregnant, and it was a want-to thing, and so I decided that I wanted to stay home and raise children, and I didn't want to work right then, so that's what I did.
So you had mentioned that you were kind of uncomfortable around kids at one time. When you started raising your own kids, did you experience any difficulty with the transition of being a mom, or did it come pretty naturally for you?
No, I had decided I wanted to do it. I had a friend who had children before me, and it just seemed like a very cool, sweet, wonderful, joyous thing to do, and she seemed really happy. And although always before I had said, never me, never, 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 I'm not going to have those monsters. I don't want them. I'm sorry I had to be one. You know, I just didn't like kids. It's really funny, actually. But I really wanted to have my children, and I was ready, and I like being a mom. I mean, as much as anyone likes it. I mean, you know, you go through some really rough times being a mom and being a blind mom, but I really enjoyed it, and I don't.
Okay, the Internet's kind of messing up a little bit here. Hopefully our connection won't get too weird. Are there any things about your children's lives growing up that you think people might be interested in hearing? Any funny experiences that you might have had, or anything that might be entertaining?
Oh, probably, but I can't really think of anything right off the top of my head, except that one of the misnomers that most people have is that the easiest, the hardest thing that, you know, when people who can see find out you're pregnant, they become so alarmed. Oh, how are you going to change it? How are you going to this and how are you going to that? And man, that was so, so easy compared to the worst thing that I had with my kids was homework. Homework and communication with teachers and seeing that they got an equal opportunity in school due to my lack of being able to help them and look over their shoulder and give them assistance. That was the number one hard thing. It was also very difficult. I was fortunate enough to have a sighted husband who could drive, and my children were involved in a lot of extracurricular activities. But it was difficult because I had three of them, and they would all be going different directions. And, of course, I couldn't jump in and drive them, and so there was lots of carpools and having to rely on others to get your children places and not wanting to impose on them and drag you as well and, you know, things like that. The typical blind stuff we deal with, you know, every day.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, we all have to deal with those kinds of things. I would think that if you have a family and things like that, it's just enhanced a little bit more unless you really have live in an area where you can either walk places or take buses or cabs or somehow or other get yourself from place to place. Were you doing anything with your music during this time of your life?
Yes, actually that is when the music kicked in, not in the very early years of my children, but actually the music kicked in, let me think, well, I would say midway, you know, when I was in the thick of being a mom and all that. That's pretty much when most of my music career happened, actually. And I had a very dear friend that I went to church with who thought that my voice should be recorded and said that he was willing to fund the venture. And so he and his wife became my sort of managers or agents, and she worked at a Christian bookstore. So they got me in the Tri-State Gospel Music Association, and they started carting me around all kinds of singing things, and me and the little munchkins went everywhere when they were small, and then I just kept on doing that and just kept going around and singing. Had a regular, you know, evangelistic ministry at that time. Never did anything in the secular realm, and I regret that now. I don't think I was in the position at that time. It's just not the way things fell, but that's another dream I have. Never in my life. I've always been on my own. I've never sung with a band. You know, I'm ready, man. Anybody know a band that wants a singer? I'm ready.
I'd love to come to you. I just think that would be a real trip. So when you went out singing, what did you use for background music?
I used my AutoHarp. I bought a new one, actually. And then I got an Omnicord. I don't know if any of you have heard of that, but I find it extremely embarrassing now when I listen to those tapes because it was all I had. And like I said, I've just never been good enough on the keyboard to accompany myself. I can't play and sing at the same time. It's a disaster. I don't know if I have a one-track mind or what, but I just can't do it. I'm not that great at the keyboard. I can do it for my own pleasure, but when I play, I play, and when I sing, I sing. I did use some tape tracks, but I'm not one who is real fond of tape tracks unless they leave me the liberty to do my own thing with my voice and the song. And so although I do mess around with karaoke a little bit now, I don't like it real well because it's too mechanical and it doesn't leave me much liberty to change the voice or slow it down or emphasize certain parts or anything like that. So I used my Omnicord and the AutoHarp most of the time, except when I was at church. Sometimes I would do specials that they would ask me to do, and I'd have an accompanist at that point.
So what's next in the life of Peg? As your children were growing up and things like that, what was your next venture as far as any career or anything like that goes?
Well, let's see. At one point, while I was into the singing and all that stuff, my husband lost his job, and I was determined that with the government rules that there were, that being blind, college educated, and a woman had to mean something, and that I had to be able to find work. At that time, all my children were in school, and I felt that I could at least work some. So I contacted rehab and told them I was willing to work, and the first thing I got was some private tutoring that I did with two blind children at the high school where my children went. And so I did that for a while, and I tutored them. It was really interesting. I did work with them some on their schoolwork, particularly math, and it was really a shocking experience and quite interesting. They did all their math on an abacus, and they didn't know how to use it properly. So it was a real interesting experience trying to work with them on that. And I worked with them on, you know, English, because that was my expertise, and spelling and that sort of thing. But I did a lot more work with them on urging them. They were both very sheltered. And I, you know, they didn't, the one girl didn't dress herself, didn't run her own bath water, didn't, so, you know, I began to work with them on daily living skills as well. So it was quite an interesting experience. And the girl, I feel very proud, is now married and out on her own. She did have a lot of learning disabilities on top of the blindness, but it was a real interesting part. And then I heard this rumor floating around while I was doing that, that somebody had been in the Portsmouth area talking about starting a radio reading service. And I was familiar with radio reading services because I had friends in the Columbus area that had had that. And I thought, well, that's just right up my alley. I'm a communication, got a degree in communications. I'm going to run that. When they started, I'm going to be right there and I'm going to run it. So basically that's what I did. I went to the planning, heard about when they had the planning meetings, and I had to work as a volunteer for the first couple of years when they started the thing, because there was no money. We had zilch money. So basically I just decided I was going to be there and make it happen, and so that's what I did. And so now I'm still there. We actually went on the air April 27th of 1990, and we're still there. And we had a lot of people that said we couldn't do it. You know, it's a rural area, and you can't do it. But we do it, and we broadcast about 68 hours a week of local programming, and then we have state programming from other reading services that's piped in by the state the rest of the time. So we're on the air with something 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is a lot more than a lot of large services have. So I'm really, really proud of the fact that we're still here. And they said we couldn't do it. All the national people said, well, you know, all these rural services usually fall by the wayside. But so far, we're still hanging in there. And I just kept looking for grants and monies and everything, and finally got some money to where I actually started getting paid. And so that's pretty much my career now.
Wow, that's wonderful. I really admire you for that and for your tenacity, because a lot of people, you know, when they run into problems like that, would just feel like giving up. And it's really neat that you were just willing to stick it out and to take the risk. And you're a great role model, I think, for a lot of us that kind of feel like we can't do things or like we're stuck in a rut. So 13 years, that's a wonderful time span to be involved in something like that. Did you do anything else in your life, and are you doing anything else with your music?
I kind of put the music on hold. I got involved with the radio reading service, and one of the ways I tried to get involved with the radio reading service in the beginning was to incorporate it with the American Council of the Blind. And the American Council of the Blind of Ohio said that if we would start a local chapter, that they would let us use their 501c3 and be the fiscal agent for the Scioto Radio Reading Service. So I started an ACB local chapter so that I could try to get some money and some help there. The chapter is no more, because what happened was the radio reading service grew a lot faster than the chapter did, and I stepped down as president, and they never had another meeting after that. But I got involved for a long time with the ACB chapter. We had it for a couple of years, And I got involved with the radio reading service, and of course my children were growing and they were in high school. They had a lot of extracurricular activities I was always going to and involved in. My one daughter in particular was very active in sports and always and continued that through her senior year of college. So that kind of stuff just kept me to where I kind of stepped away from the music, and I'm just now kind of revisiting the music and doing a little bit of a gig here and there, and just kind of wanting to go back that way again. But I, there for a while, I just put it down. There was some other things involved with it. My husband wasn't real keen on dragging me around. He was getting, when I got to where I lived far away from these people who were my original agents, and so I would have to rely on my husband to drag me back and forth, and it got kind of tiring to him too. So it was just one of those deals where other things just took over. So I hope to get back involved with the music a lot more now.
Well, I'll tell you, if we have anything to do with it, you will. Because you have an absolutely beautiful voice. There's no doubt about that. So how did you find out about For the People?
Well, for those of you who know April, that's where I found out about it. April and I went to school together, and when I first got onto the computer, which we didn't get on that either, but when I first, that was through my job, the rehab people bought me a computer, and I knew absolutely nothing about it, and they told me how to turn it on, and that was about it. And so I was like bugging everybody that had one to try to learn how to operate it. I'm sure we've all been in that situation. Anyway, April first turned me on to IRC chatting, or Merck, as a lot of people know it, and wanted me to chat, and that's text chatting, and I started doing that. And then she turned me on to a program called Vox Chat. And actually, I met a lot of the people who are on For the People now. Oki Man, I met on Vox Chat, and Anita, I met on Vox Chat, and a few other people, I can't remember. But anyway, I got into that, so then I hated it. I didn't like the way it made my voice sound, so I quit talking on it. It just made me sound terrible, like I'd had a stroke or had a few drinks or something. I met Jock on Vox Chat also. I'm pretty sure it was on Vox Chat. And then I also chatted with him on IRC. So I met a lot of the For the People on Vox Chat. But then April told me about For the People, and got me to come here and chat, and so that was my first exposure to this site.
So what do you see in the future for Miss Peg? What's going on now, and within the next 5 or 10 years, what do you anticipate is going to be happening in your life?
Ooh, hey, I live one day at a time, girlfriend. I don't know what's going to happen to me in the next 5 or 10 years. And when I look over my life and see what has happened, I have absolutely no clue where I'll be 5 or 10 years from now. But I right now plan to stay and hopefully continue the music. And right now I plan to continue the reading service. Another thing that I didn't mention earlier is I also got involved in the in the business enterprise program, because I basically did it so that my husband, he never did find work, so I basically did it because my husband needed something to do, and we needed more money, so I got into that, and I basically did that, so he really enjoyed it while he had it, and I am not married now, so I, as of June, I do still have... I do still have a vending location, but as of June 13th, on my birthday, I will resign, and I don't plan to do that anymore. That's a closed part of my career, because I really did that for him, and I don't wish to do that anymore.
Well, I think that all the experiences that we have in our lives, whether they're good or bad or whatever they might be, some of them, even though they might be bad at the time, they have enhanced our resources as we go through our lives. And you were talking about a few things like that, like your teaching. Even though you didn't actually go into that after college, you were able to use it later on as a tutor And I think that's a good lesson for all of us, because a lot of times, you know, we do things in our lives that we think, oh my goodness, why did I do that? And then all of a sudden something will come up where we can actually use that skill. So I think I'm going to close the formal part of the interview right now, because I know you have an appointment to attend, and so do I. So I think I'll leave the floor open to questions.
Peg, I just wanted to comment on your radio reading service. I know that we talked about it back some time ago, and it is actually one of the few radio reading services that's accessible on the Internet. And I went to your site and thoroughly enjoyed my time there, and I just thought you might want to mention to folks that it is available on the Internet. And I loved your interview.
Thank you. And yes, we are on the Internet, and we are streaming. And our web address, and I can maybe after we are finished with this, we can put it up there. But it's www.scioto, that's S-C-I-O-T-O, S-C-I-O-T-O-R-R-S.org. And you do have to have a username and password, and there's a place where we ask you to register. I'm easy. I just want people on the site. So I will, if you ask me for it, I'll give you the username and password, but I'm not going to give it to you on here simply because we do want to know who is on our website, and I want to make it kind of official so that I know that somebody asked for the username and password, if that makes any sense. We have to have that for copyright protection. For the privilege of being able to read the printed publications, we have to protect ourselves according to FCC law with a username and a password. But it is there. It does use Windows Media Player. It's very stable. It sounds pretty decent, I think. I'm very proud of it.
Wow. See, now that was something we didn't get into in the preliminary. I had no idea you had your own website. How cool.
Steve Powers.
Yeah, hi, Peg. And Ma, you did a great job, Ma. I really enjoyed that. Peg, for an ignorant Englishman, can you tell us what a radio reading service is?
Sure, and I don't know if they have them in England or not. Maybe they do, but a radio reading service is a service that is provided to people who qualify, which include people who are blind or visually impaired and those who cannot read a normal print publication due to any number of injuries, either possibly stroke injuries, head injuries. Maybe they cannot turn pages or adequately hold a book due to cerebral palsy, arthritis, things like that. Anyone that has, for some reason, if they have an extreme learning disability and they're unable to read, anything that keeps them from reading normal print publications. Our main purpose is to provide current, timely information, current events like local newspapers, local and state and national newspapers, magazines, periodicals, books, programs of special interest to those who are of our listening audience. So that's what we are. And there are different mediums by which people deliver radio reading services. We do stream on the web. Our service provides special receivers to our listeners that only get our station, and we air it over a FM subcarrier signal. We have a main channel who allows us to lease their subcarrier, and which is for those who aren't radio savvy. It's like a little, it's kind of like sideband. It's like a little side frequency that can be generated off of the main channel frequency of an FM radio station. And so that's in a nutshell what a radio reading service is.
Neil Cox.
Peg, how difficult is it to fund? Do you get much help from people, or how do you fund it?
It is a little bit difficult. We are very, very fortunate here in the state of Ohio, where our public broadcasting state, the state agent that funds, that provides state monies for the public broadcasting, has taken us under their umbrella. That is not the case in a lot of states. And that, of course, you still have to find matching monies, and you just have to It's just like any other we are a nonprofit. It's just like we don't charge for our service. So it's just like any other nonprofit agency. You got to be at the streets, and you never know for sure. And last year, I really thought we were going to bite the dust. We really have had a lot of funding problems recently. But it is a program that appeals to a lot of people because people do love to read and people are sympathetic to our cause. So it does have a very philanthropic appeal to people. So if you can get the word out to the right people that have the bucks, you can fund it, but it is a constant battle to do so.
I have a question for those in England who might not know exactly the mechanics of what goes into a radio reading service. What types of things do you have read?
Well, there's a Talking Newspaper Association. We get our sort of material on either cassette or email, and some now on CDs as text files, but nothing like Pat's describing. It sounds a really good idea.
Yeah, the problem that you have with the tapes and cassettes, of course, is that they aren't current. And we read department store ads, grocery ads. So I can listen to those grocery ads and know what is on sale at my supermarket this week. I can listen to the radio reading service on a daily basis and be aware of calendar of events, social activities. I can read the current magazines. Newsweek, for instance, or Time, those are weekly publications, and we can get those and we can read them in a current fashion so that people are able to read them the same as anyone else would. As far as books, we can read current bestsellers, and it takes a while for those to come out on tape many times, although that's getting better all the time with these road reader books. But, you know, so the whole idea is that it gives you the privilege to read things that normally we would not have had access to.
Do you have quite a plethora of volunteers that read for you?
We could use a lot more. We're in a real small area, so that's our main problem. And most of the people who want to volunteer are women and retired, and they don't want to drive at night. So we have some problems because, you know, we read our newspaper in the evening, so we have problems there. But we do have, you know, quite a few volunteers, and it's a real appealing volunteer job because they know they're helping hundreds of people by coming into their living rooms and simply reading, but it doesn't have the emotional drain to it that a lot of one-on-one volunteer situations do. So it has a real appeal to a lot of people. And, you know, of all walks of life, I have a young man that just came in who is a post-secondary student. He's in high school, but he is going to college as well in the mornings, getting credits. And so he does have a little bit of downtime between the time he has to be at the high school and the time his college classes are. So he's coming in and doing a money-type program, a business-type program, and reading articles from Money Magazine and Forbes and some of those. And it's just amazing. The young man is just doing a wonderful job and is very dependable. And then we've got my oldest volunteer is 95, and she comes in each and every Thursday morning at 11:30 our time and reads. Just amazes me. Just wonderful that she does that. So we have volunteers from, of course, you can imagine my poor kids, you know, when I couldn't find a reader, you go, "Wanna read department store ads?" You know, they have all read their share.
Bill Coyce.
When you're reading a book, how do you go about it? Do you read, say, take a particular book and read an hour each day until you get to the end of it, or how do you do it?
Yeah, that's exactly how we do it. Of course, I make my readers record it ahead of time so that I know the whole book is there, and then we just air it a little bit each day. It's how we do it at the present time. We also have another program, which is a statewide program here in Ohio called the Ohio Telephone Reader. And it is amazing what we're doing on that. We are bringing the all the local news. If for those of you who are familiar with Newsline, it's much like that. The cool thing about the telephone reader is that we can control what we put on it. And we have, I believe, 24 24 daily newspapers on it for all of our listeners in the state of Ohio, and we're still adding more. And then we have several weekly, biweekly publications on there. And it uses DeckTalk at the present time. We're experiencing, we're experimenting with some other speech options so that we can have voice recognition. Right now it just uses the touch tone, but you can actually scan through articles on that and listen to just the sports page or the obituaries. We have it divided into categories. We don't have books on there, but we do have the appeal about that, which is bad about the radio reading services, that, you know, although the reading service is a wonderful privilege, it doesn't offer you any choice. I mean, you know, if you want to listen to a book, you've got to tune in a half hour every day or an hour every day, or you're going to miss the book. And the same with the newspapers. You've got to listen to the whole thing if you want to hear obituaries. You've got to wait until the obituaries come on. So this has opened a whole new world for people who are blind and visually impaired to be able to read the newspaper more like a sighted person. And Ohio is really proud of our telephone reader. It's really come a long way.
Peggy, I thought you had a beautiful interview, and I can certainly attest to being left abandoned, so to speak. It's not a good feeling.
Well, we're getting down to the wire here as far as time. I think we'll take like one or two more questions, and then we'll wrap it up.
And just a quick comment. Great interview, Peg and Marg, and great job of questioning.
Well, thank you. And I was I don't know who the person was that asked about my high school years. I'm not really sure what they were asking. But I had great high school years, whoever asked that. I don't know. I guess we did sort of skip, but my life has been so busy that it's hard to fit it all in there.
Pittsburgh, a really great interview, and you're just terrific, Peg. I was just wondering, and glad to hear so many people in here. My Braille piece, John, could you email me the URL and the password? Would that be all right? I don't know other way that I know of to get it.
Well, when we're not recording anymore, I can just text it up there. I would think that Becky would think that would be okay for anyone who wants the website. And then there's a link to the website where you can request the username and password from me if you want.
That sounds like a wonderful thing. And it's really neat when a person's life is so full that you can't cover it in an hour. That certainly means that you have a lot going on in your life, and you don't have a whole lot of time to get bored, and that's a good thing. I think a lot of us would really love to be in that position sometimes. And Peg, I am so honored and privileged to have had the opportunity to interview you. It was a lot of fun, and I was going to tell you just briefly this experience. My phone was dead. Now, this is what the power of the internet and the power of for the people can do. I was text messaging with her on MSN, and my phone was dead, and I had no way to call anybody. So she offered to call my friend here in town and tell her that my phone was dead, and ask her if she would come and help me figure out what was going on. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to call anybody in town. So Peg was my hero. And, of course, throughout the past month, we've become great friends. And once again, it was wonderful to be able to put you in the spotlight here on For the People.
Thank you, Mar, and thank you, Peg. That was a great interview. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I know everyone did. I want to thank everyone for coming today and invite you to come back next week when our own very favorite shepherd boy, Steve Shepherd, will be in the spotlight.